This is Book News. I'm Skip Hadesley. This week in Book News, someone is telling you to burn your copies of 50 Shades of Grey, and not because it's bad. Advocates for West Side Women in Need, an anti-domestic violence group, claims it is disgusting and sends out the wrong message glorifying the physical and sexual abuse of naive women by older men. It seems West Side Women in Need have confirmed my thoughts on the subject all along. E.L. James needs to get slapped. Beloved children's book heroes, the Hardy Boys, are making a comeback, but this time with a gritty adult feel. Author J.K. Rowling is slated to write the first book in a new series called The Hardy Boys and the Secret of the Sorcerer's Phoenix. Rowling has reported that Joe Hardy will be addicted to meth and have red hair, while his brother Frank will be an orphan on absinthe who dreams of magic and has a lightning bolt scar, both a part of Gryffindor. Now, the New York Times and bestsellers and fiction recap. The Light Between the Oceans by M.L. Stedman surfaces at number 5. Philippa Gregory's Kingmaker's Daughter makes its debut at number 4. Where We Belong by Emily Griffin proves that it still belongs at number 3. The Inn at Rose Harbor by Debbie McCumber comes in at number 2. And the number 1 spot goes to Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. Again, this has been Book News. I'm Skip Hadesley, signing off.
Welcome to Booked, where two guys tell you about the books they're reading. I'm Rob Olson.
And I'm Livia Snedden. This is a special bonus episode for us as we have an author interview. We haven't done this in quite a while, huh?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah. Our author this evening is Paul Tremblay, who is the author of The Little Sleep and No Sleep Till Wonderland, and of course, one of our more recent reviews, Swallowing a Donkey's Eye. Here is some of his bio from Amazon. He is a 3-time nominee of the Bram Stoker Award, has sold over 50 short stories to markets such as Razor Magazine, Weird Tales, Last Pentacle of the Sun, writings in support of the West Memphis 3, and Best American Fantasy 3. He is the author of the short speculative fiction collection Compositions for the Young and Old and In the Meantime, and the novellas City Pier, Above and Below, and The Harlequin and The Train. He has served as fiction editor of Shizine and as co-editor of Fantasy Magazine, and was also the co-editor of the Fantasy, Bandersnatch, and Phantom anthologies.
Paul, thanks so much for coming on the show. I'm really glad to have you here.
Well, thank you, guys. I'm very excited to be on. To take the chair of Sean Ferguson is sort of a big step up for me.
Wow. All right. Speaking of Sean Ferguson, some people heard his take on Swallowing a Donkey's Eye, as well as ours. Can you tell us in your words kind of what you feel that story is about?
When I've had that question recently, I think I said in like in a blog interview, I didn't want to sound like too coy as like a novelist to say like, oh, it took me the whole book to say what I wanted to say. But, you know, in a weird way, more than anything else I've written, I mean, this book has been 7-8 years in sort of coming from first draft to finally being published. In one way, I had the luxury to spend all these many years sort of working on the book to get it, I guess, as close to what I wanted it to be. But at the same time, I think I almost worked on it too much that I lost all objectivity. I don't know. Despite all the weirdness, I mean, sort of the dystopian political satire sort of backdrop, in a weird way, this is really one of my most autobiographical pieces. If I don't know if that makes any sense or not. So what it's about, and I don't know, it's about a whole lot of different things to me. I guess in terms of plot, you know, it's about sort of this nameless narrator who's an indentured servant or indentured worker at this giant mega conglomerate called Farm. He has to find his mommy who he fears is, homeless in city. And if you're homeless in the city, you get shipped below the pier. So there's sort of, I guess, those three different levels to it. Yeah, so I don't know if I answered the question or not.
No, that's good. I mean, it is a complex story, so there's no really brief way to describe it, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've had a hard time sort of describing what are, like, the favorite parts of the book to me because they sort of happen later in the book. And for the most part, I feel like the book is being pitched about, like, sort of its, you know, the beginning where he starts in this place called Farm, and it's a really sort of strange dystopian setup where, you know, our narrator works at this place where this giant company makes all the food for city, and they do like wacky stuff like, you know, they engineer all the animals despite telling the public that it's all sort of natural organic stock. they not only do they engineer the animals, but they engineer them for silence. But then they want to make money off of people coming to visit the farm, so they have to pump in fake animal noises. But that's all within like the first like 20 pages.
Jokingly, when you were saying that it was somewhat autobiographical, because I don't think we were expecting it, Livia's typed into our document "duck suit" with a question mark. So, is it
chicken suit all the way?
Oh, it's chicken suit. That's not going to make sense to anybody that's listening, but it's kind of funny.
You mentioned you've been working on this book for 7 or 8 years, which kind of ties into another question we had. We noticed your novella City Pier. How does that relate to Swallowing a Donkey's Eye?
So I guess earlier in, 2002, 2003, I wrote 3 or 4 short stories that were set in the City Pier world. That was just sort of an idea that I had of a technological city, sort of near future, but almost out of time. A technologically advanced westernized city that's built above this giant wooden pier. And the pier itself is hundreds of feet tall, and the city is so big and the pier is so big, the pier itself is a practically infinite network of wooden struts and beams, etc. And sort of the political sort of slant of it was, if you were homeless in the city, you'd be shipped below the pier. So this is really early on in my sort of writing career, I guess, that I wrote a few stories sort of exploring the concept of this place. So when I had the idea for this novel and set it in farm, I figured I'd try to sort of not shoehorn it necessarily into the City Pier world, but I guess I wanted to explore it a little bit more. I wanted to explore the satire elements a little bit more than I did with the original stories that I wrote. The original stories I wrote were pretty much straightforward, science fiction noir sort of mixes. Whereas this, I think, leans a lot more towards satire and sort of the Kurt Vonnegut vein. Not saying I'm as good as Kurt Vonnegut, but he's certainly someone I had in mind when I was writing the book.
So I don't know if you had a chance to listen to what we had to say about the book, but we noticed that there were some themes with some naming that you did and stuff like that. So, for example, the Farm Animals Resistance Today, I think it was what it was called.
Yeah.
Fart. And then there was Barn Manager, which was shortened down to BM, and then the mayor's initials were ASS. So that's kind of like I have it in the poop category.
The poop theme. Oh boy, that theme will be studied for years when people are reading my novels 50 years from now. sorry, go ahead, finish what you're going to say.
BM was the one that we weren't sure whether that was just coincidental or intentional. I think Sean's really waiting to hear back about that. So that's going to be the first question. Was that part of the poop theme?
Yes. And oddly enough, I didn't realize that the mayor's initials were ass.
Well, there you go.
The first two are certainly, were purposeful. Yeah. But with the mayor's name, I actually was going to name him after a friend, a writer friend, but then when I changed his last name to Solomon, which we might talk about later, I left my friend's initials in. So yeah, when I was listening to your podcast, I was like, oh yeah, A.S. Solomon. So I, to backtrack a little bit, I did listen to your podcast. I usually try to avoid reading like every review and positive or negative, but, I know Sean, and this is my first booked podcast, and I really enjoyed the conversation. One of the things that I was very gratified to hear you guys discuss was sort of, you guys saw my plan, whether or not it worked or not, but I went into the book wanting to be like really over the top with the humor early on, like in Farm, and then gradually get more serious, less outwardly humorous or less outrageously humorous. So yeah, early on, I definitely wanted to go for some really, over the top stuff like the fart acronym and barn manager as BM, et cetera. Cause I really wanted to have that sort of juxtaposition by the end of the book of sort of more serious emotional stuff compared to, the really outrageous humor that was in the beginning of the novel.
Good. I'm glad to hear that was intentional because it worked really well. It was one of the things that I think made it something that I liked so much.
Thanks.
So the obvious other themes that we had were the kind of biblical style names of, what was it, Joseph, and the guy's last name is Solomon, and Jonah, right? Jonah, I think is the other
one.
Sure.
Actually, the mom's name, who I don't mention very often, her name is Mary.
Okay.
Oh.
So that was an intentional theme as well, right?
Yeah, it was. It was. I tried not to be too, I guess, overt with it, but I mean, it's kind of hard not to be when you see a name like Jonas and eventually Solomon thrown around. I figured it would get picked up on eventually, but Yeah, I sort of, in a weird, twisted way, it's almost a, I don't want to say a religious parable because I'm not religious either, but I want to do like an almost like weird, twisted retelling of, you know, the Judeo-Christian sort of story, I guess. It could maybe even be argued that the narrator's name is Jesus, which I never divulge, but yeah, no, that was purposeful as well.
Cool. And then the final one, which I thought was the one I liked the most, was just the way that you very simply titled things. So the city was called City, the farm was called Farm, the place where the father helps the people is called Home and stuff. And I like it. What was your thought behind doing that? I think it was nice, but I want to hear, you know, kind of why you chose to do that.
Yeah, it's funny. Part of it was a little bit of a holdover from just my earlier City Pier stuff, where I just called it, you know, very basic City and Pier. And honestly, when I first went into the book, I started just calling it Farm because I wanted to get into like where are they, what country are we in. I wanted to keep it basic. Here's Farm. It could be, you know, even though it's a very recognizably sort of Western culture kind of place, you know, it could be anywhere. It's not an East Coast or a West Coast or a middle of the country kind of thing. Well, I mean, I suppose it has to be East Coast or West Coast if you're above the ocean. But, you know, I wasn't going for a particular geographic location other than, you know, on a coastline. But, you know, in a weird way, a lot of the stuff, especially in the beginning, and I think this is why it took me so long to finish the book, I just embraced every sort of weird idea that I had initially without even necessarily knowing what it meant at the time. And just, I guess, trusted my subconscious as a writer and trusted that I would figure out what it meant to me as I went. And if I didn't, you know, I would cut it or make it work in some other way. So I don't know if that makes sense. I think Kelly Link has even written an essay about how writers need to trust their subconscious more. I'm definitely a big proponent for that. That's sort of be the fun as a writer. Sometimes I'll put something in and I don't understand what it means, but I will by the time the story finishes. Almost all the time.
Well, I think it worked out because I think it plays into that whole totalitarian thing where it's like everything is just very homogenized and, you know, everything's the same kind of thing. Just very simple, basic names, no branding, that type of thing.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, sort of definitely the whole idea of, you know, just, you know, conformity, et cetera. Yeah. You said it better than I did. So.
One more bit of interrogation before we stop making you disclose everything about this story. And this came up in our podcast too. We couldn't figure out if the guy with the face tattooed on the back of his head, if we were missing something there, or if he was just a guy with a face tattooed on the back of his head.
In terms of like, you know, so I mean, I guess a little bit, he's sort of two-faced, and not so much in terms of how he treats the narrator, but in terms of how he presents himself. You know, when he first presents himself to the narrator, he's sort of this gruff proletariat, you know, pissed off at the bosses, you know, hates Farm, et cetera. But, you know, within the first few chapters, you kind of figure out that, you know, he loves that place and sort of needs it. Like, he follows the rules more closely than anybody else.
He's a lifer.
Yeah, definitely. He's a lifer. Like, his mom was his first barn manager. Yeah, and he's actually somebody, again, he started off with, I saw a picture in the Boston Globe of one of the motorcycle rallies that they have up in like northern Maine or New Hampshire. And there was a picture of a dude that looked just like Jonah. It was a guy, you know, with bald, long beard, and he had a tattoo of his own face on the back of his head. I just thought that was, wow, it was an amazing visual. So that was definitely something I felt like I had to figure out. I wanted to use that sort of his image, his visage, and then sort of figure it out later in the book.
I like it a lot. That makes a lot of sense now that you mentioned like kind of his overall life theme of pretending to be more proletarian.
Yeah, we were too narrow on our thoughts on that one, I think, just too focused on the narrator.
Yeah. All right, so not to beat your book to death, but there was one other thing that, I mean, obviously when you go for the type of government system that you have in your book, people, you know, will compare it to other literary works. Was there any kind of, you know, Orwell or Huxley kind of influence for you, or just curious if there's any literary influences there?
Oh, definitely. I love dystopian fiction, especially the classics. I'm a huge Orwell fan. I try not even to shy away from the fact that Animal Farm is one of my favorite novels that I've read and reread. You know, I quote from it in the epigraph. Kurt Vonnegut, also, I think I mentioned him earlier, but, you know, he's one of my absolute favorites. I used to, there was a, like a 10-year stretch where I would read and reread Slaughterhouse-Five and Breakfast of Champions every June. I don't know why June, but it just happened to be every June I would read those two books, or reread those two books again. Yeah, it was funny, when I've been doing like a few like conventions and readings, I've started each one with a terrible joke about how, since I've been writing in the speculative fiction sort of world, it's sort of a law that you have to write a dystopian novel at some point. So I finally fulfilled the, that aspect of my writing career, I guess.
Take that, Livius. Okay, so in the history of us having this podcast, Livius has always made fun of me for being a big Vonnegut fan. So I'm feeling a little bit of vindication.
I've not made fun of you for being a big Vonnegut fan. I've read that some of his stuff was very good. You just are very, very embraceful of Vonnegut. So
I am a little evangelical about, I mean, yes. But at the same time, well, the joke at the beginning was that, you know, any book that we read, I'd say, if you like this, read this Vonnegut book, you know, no matter what it was.
If you like 50 Shades of Grey.
Read Galapagos. Actually, yeah. No, don't do that.
All right. So your bio mentions that you're a 3-time Stoker Award nominee. Now, is that the award for dystopian political satire?
I wish. The Bram Stoker Award is the award given out by the Horror Writers Association.
That was my cute way of saying that Swallowing a Donkey's Eye was about as far from a Stoker Award nominee as I can imagine reading.
No, absolutely. Well, yeah, I was going to say that wouldn't stop the Stokers from doing whatever they want to do. I'm grateful, but my first novel, The Little Sleep, which was about a narcoleptic private detective, had no horrific elements whatsoever, was a finalist for the Bram Stoker Award. Yeah, I can't really explain why. I mean, I was happy for the nod, but didn't seem to make sense or fit with me. But anyway, I digress.
Wow, cool. Another quick thing about the bio that you have on Amazon mentions that you have a master's in math, some sort of math. Have you ever thought about incorporating some of those studies into something that you're writing?
I have, but I haven't really sort of, I guess, I haven't tried too hard, I guess, if it hasn't like come sort of naturally. Yeah, so I do have a master's in, really, there's only one kind of math.
Okay.
not, I guess, the old math, not the new math. I actually didn't start writing or really didn't think about messing around with writing until after I got out of grad school. I was like, oh, I did that. Let's, I guess, try writing. I don't know. But no, I guess I've never really written a math story. I teach high school math by day. So I don't know if I sort of keep those two things separate. I kind of like to use, you know, the math side of my brain when I'm teaching at school. And then when I'm out, I sort of get to use the other side of my brain.
When Livius mentioned that as a potential question, I was like, oh, yeah, just like David Foster Wallace.
Oh, he has a master's in math?
No, he it was weird. I looked it up, too, because I thought that was the case, but I didn't want to sound like an asshole. So I looked it up and he has his MFA had a focus on math, which sounds really weird, but actually I have his Wikipedia page up, so let's see. Oh no, his undergrad at Amherst College majored in English and philosophy with a focus on modal logic and mathematics.
Interesting. Yeah, I've been actually pleasantly surprised to find more writers than you would think with a math background. Stuart Onan, for example, I don't know if you've read him, but you know, he's, you know, I think one of the best American novelists working right now, you know, and he was an engineer as an undergrad, didn't start messing around with writing until after that. So there's a few, I guess, math nerds kicking around out there.
Well, I mean, our man Vonnegut, I don't remember exactly what his degree was in, but I think he was in accounting or something. Definitely.
That's
not.
That's right. I think it was accounting. That's right. He was an accountant first. Yep.
Bam. I wonder if there's something to that. Now we're kind of putting these pieces together. There's got to be something to maybe the idea of like switching from one side of your brain to the other or something.
Well, I just hope that someday when they do make a Back to School 2, I'll get to make the Vonnegut cameo appearance instead.
Oh, I forgot he was in that. Wow. I'm watching that once this is done tonight.
Yeah, I'm just glad someone got that reference.
Livius, you're still here, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm still here. You guys lost me.
He's riveted. I could talk. Yeah, sorry.
It's okay. You mentioned The Little Sleep. The Bram Stoker nominated The Little Sleep.
That's right.
Are there any plans for a third installment in that series? Is it a series?
I have a third idea, although it might be kind of totally dead right now. But anyway, the publisher was only a 2-book deal, and they weren't interested in a third, and I wasn't necessarily interested in writing a third at the time either. I actually wasn't even interested in writing a second, to be honest. When I turned in the Little Sleep to my agent, I felt, I was sort of in that new book glow. I just finished the book. I turned it into my agent, so I was feeling confident with, having no real reason to feel confident. I told him, look, I know how publishing works. I just want a one book. This is the only book I'm writing. I'm not writing anymore. I figured that they would ask for a series with this character. It's like, I told his story. This is his book. And my agent was like, oh yeah, sure, no problem. So, Henry Holt came in with a 2-book deal, and, thankfully so. And it was a great offer. But of course they wanted a second book featuring the same character. So I figured there were worse problems in life to have than having to write a second book. So that's where No Sleep from Wonderland came from. That was definitely the hardest sort of writing experience I've ever had, is writing that second novel. Because even as a reader, I'm not interested in series. I don't know. I tend to be a little ADD in that regard. I like to read different writers and different books and bounce around and not necessarily reread the same thing over and over again. So when I had to write No Sleep to Wonderland, now I had a... I had a deadline, gave me an advance, and so I had, this book had to happen. And it took me at least like 5 or 6 months of hair pulling and nail biting and stressing out about what the heck am I going to write about. I already told the story, but I was able to figure it out. And I'm very glad I wrote the book. I learned a lot writing that novel, and I do think it's a good novel too.
Do you think that struggle came from the pressure of knowing that you had to do it?
I definitely think that was definitely a part of it. But I also, just because I'm a whiny little bastard sometimes, it's like, I already wrote Mark Chenevich's story. What took me was finding sort of a thematic way in. So The Little Sleep, this is not really giving anything away, but The Little Sleep is very much about Mark Chenevich's past. So I said, okay, thematically, the second book will be about his present, like sort of what he has to deal with in day-to-day life. And if there was ever to be a third novel, I could sort of make it thematically about the future. And that was sort of my way into the book.
So we heard a little bit about the problems of having to write books. We recently saw Manarchy Magazine put up a little video of how to properly deal with rejection. Is that an accurate portrayal of how you deal with like bad reviews?
Yes. To the point where, I've sort of had to make a rule for myself that I don't allow myself to respond. And this goes for like anyone, just like if I send out my short stories or books to first readers for input, or even, my editors give me their edits, I do not allow myself for a full 24 hours to talk to anybody about a review or 24 hours just to be a miserable son of a bitch and be like, they don't know what the hell they're talking about, and get all pissy. And then usually after 24 hours passes, I'm much more calm. And especially in the case of edits, I can sort of see their side, or if not see their side, at least suggest sort of like the common ground. Or after 24 hours, I feel like I can be objective enough to say, no, I'm going to stick with what I have here, type of thing. So yeah, it definitely, for me, it never gets easier to see a bad review or to take sort of rejection or criticism.
Now I kind of regret that we're a podcast, because there's no way that you could frame that and put it up on a wall.
This is true. I cannot. Well, maybe I got to figure it. Yeah, maybe some sort of hologram. But then I would need the images of you and of Rob, Liv, and Sean Ferguson.
Yeah.
Sean Ferguson in a hologram. I think that might be my next story.
Where he belongs, in a hologram.
I only bring this up because you mentioned Sean a couple of times. Earlier, about half hour before we got on, I sent him a message and just said, hey, we're going to be on with Tremblay in 30 minutes. Are there any questions you'd like us to ask on your behalf? So because we're notorious for outing each other, or Rob and I are, with the text messages and stuff that go back and forth between us, it says, ask him what he's going to do to prepare for being in the same room as me. Apparently, he's going to be at an event that you're going to be at, I believe, sometime next month.
Well, I'll make sure that I have like all my shots up to date. It's very cool. Yeah, I'm reading at the KGB in the KGB bar in New York City on September 19th. So I guess I didn't realize until recently that Sean is in New Jersey. Is that right?
Yeah.
Why don't we just give out his home address and phone number too?
Ooh, if only I had it.
Yeah. I have his phone number.
Excited to hear that he's going to go to it. I would love to meet him in person. We've only had online interactions.
He's a treat in person, but he's very huggy.
Yeah, huggy. Okay, good to know.
Right. Let's see if we can put this back on track a little bit. This isn't even a question. It's more of a, you know, hopefully more of an accolade. We first came across your writing in Warmed and Bound, which is just over a year ago now, and we weren't able to time-wise to get you on the show then. And it turns out that, and we were just reading those stories as we were having people on, and then kind of did like a follow-up. I went back and read everything that, you know, we didn't have guests from. And it turned out that Chance the Dick was one of my favorite stories. Rob actually looked it back up in our notes, but it was one of my top two stories in Warmed and Bound. So I really, really enjoyed that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's funny, that story, since we were talking about The Little Sleep earlier, the first chapter of The Little Sleep is sort of the same stereotypical private eye setup, where it's a big city private eye, beautiful woman walks in, and she holds up her hand and says, you know, someone stole my fingers and replaced them with somebody else's. You have to find them. That ended up being the first chapter of The Little Sleep. So the Chance the Dick story was me sort of just messing around trying to figure out what that sort of scene meant to me. And I did the novel and messed around with the short story a little bit at the same time. So it was kind of fun to have the two different sort of have that one scene split off and go into two different sort of universes, I guess.
I just want to say my silence after you started saying that was I was trying to go onto Amazon after you'd said that to buy The Little Sleep, and then I remembered that someone stole my Kindle. So now I'm just sad again, but that's definitely going on my Amazon wish list.
Well, thanks. I hope you enjoy it. I'm definitely very proud of that book. I think some of the humor is a little bit similar, but it's a totally different story, totally different genre, I guess. But so we'll see. Hope you like it.
One of our potential questions for you tonight was going to be, did you happen to steal a Kindle recently?
No, or... I have not. I'm don't tell them, but I'm quite mad at Amazon. Well, they know. Like, I'm not a... But I try to avoid, and I don't judge anybody else by... This is purely my personal vendetta against Amazon, mainly because I don't know if you remember the brouhaha that happened in February of 2010. Spacing on the name of my publisher. That's great. But Henry Holt is owned by, what's the big conglomerate that owns Henry Holt, Tor Books, Macmillan. There we go.
Mm-hmm.
When the publishers first tried to push back on sort of the pricing point that Amazon had been doing with their eBooks, Macmillan, the CEO of Macmillan, flew out to Seattle to talk to, what's that guy's name? Amazon CEO, Jeff Bose or something like that.
Regardless, I have no idea.
Yeah, he flew out to talk to the Amazon dude. And Amazon, how they tend to sort of react to people pushing back is by pulling all their books off their shelves. Mm. So
I do remember this, actually.
So they pulled all of Macmillan's titles off their shelves. And it happened to be the week that No Sleep Till Wonderland was released.
Oh.
So obviously it wasn't like a personal, like Amazon wasn't out to get me, but it totally killed. It totally killed the first, you know, week of my book, which is the most important week.
That's insane.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously it was just bad timing on my part. I got like an email from Macmillan. Sorry about that. Oh, thanks. Email from Amazon. Sorry about that. Thanks.
Yeah. Barnes & Noble still has your book. Oh. Damn it.
Nothing like getting a my bad from Amazon, which when you were trying to remember the name of the CEO of Amazon, I was like, his name's not Mr. Amazon?
Yeah. No, it's something. I actually know.
And don't worry, I'm pretty sure that he doesn't listen to this podcast.
You never know. They have moles everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
What are you currently working on, Paul?
Working on trying to move into a new house is really... I've been without a home for this entire month of August, essentially. We sold our house of 13 years, and we're buying a house that's like being newly built, but it wasn't quite ready, but we're finally moving in a couple of days. So I've lived in four different places in the past 15 days. It's been kind of...
Nice. And still we're courteous enough to come on and talk to us, so we really appreciate that.
Thanks for having me. I'm at my brother's right now, and he's away for the week, so I have them run at his house. But I'm slowly working on a on a novel. I'm coming off sounding like an angry person at publishing, but I'm slowly working on a novel that's going to be another sort of satire, and it's going to be sort of a satire of publishing and education and the apocalypse, I guess, all rolled into one.
Nice.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm hesitant to give away the title because I don't want someone to steal it.
Nope. Totally cool.
Other than that, I co-wrote a young adult novel with Stephen Graham Jones, and we just sort of sold that. You know, we haven't we still have the contract to go through, but Chizine Publications, the same publisher, or I should say Chizine Publications, the same publisher of the Donkey novel, will be publishing our young adult novel in a few years. So we're pretty excited about that.
Is it pronounced Chizine?
It is technically pronounced Chizine because it's short for chiaroscuro.
Oh. See, we're from Chicago, so we Chi-Town, we always go Chizine.
Yeah.
So do some other people that do stuff for them that I know personally. So
I used to be their online magazine. I called it Chizine. And then I finally, you know, got to meet Brett Savory, the president, in person. It's, like, it's Chizine, but it doesn't really matter. I'm like, oh.
Wow. You just blew my mind two ways in one sentence because you said Chizine like that, but you also said that you co-authored something with Stephen Graham Jones, which is awesome.
No, it was a lot of fun. You know, we took our time. We actually, it was like over like a span of 2 years. And it's a really sort of, hopefully fun, a little bit goofy young adult novel. The title may change, but for now it's called, what's it called? It's called The Totally Unlikely But True Adventures of Anxiety Girl and Floating Boy.
I cannot wait. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. Steven's such a great guy. It was an honor and so much fun to work with him. I sort of miss it now that we haven't been, working on a book together because, it was the back and forth almost every day.
Did you find him to be energetic?
Energetic? I just heard an email.
Okay. That guy's got so much energy and like it seems like his mind just goes at some sort of crazy RPM. Like if his mind had a sound, we wouldn't be able to hear it because it's outside of our range, like that type of thing.
Absolutely. Some of these reams of emails, I'm like, oh, these would be, and like in the old days when authors wrote letters to each other and you end up publishing those letters, I have to, without Steven's permission, someday publish all the emails that he wrote because there's some really wild stuff, with his, as you said, his mind going a million miles. But, when you meet him in person, it's a little bit of a kind of a bummer because when you stand next to Steven, you're instantly less handsome because he's the most handsome person in the room. Had that Stephen Graham Jones effect in a room, but it's sort of really humbling and ego crushing at the same time. So I prefer him to be at email now as opposed to, being with him in person. My ego can't take it.
That's fair. I can understand that.
All right. So we're getting kind of close to the end, getting ready to wrap up, but is there anything else that you'd like to talk about that maybe we didn't bring up already?
Geez, I don't know. I'll just plug an anthology that I co-edited last year called Creatures. It's still out and doing okay. It's called Creatures, 30 Years of Monster Stories, and I co-edited it with John Langan, who's also a very good author in his own right. And we tried to collect what we thought were some of the best short stories featuring monsters from the past 30 years. And we got some really cool people to be in it, including Joe Lansdale, Laird Barron, Stephen Graham Jones is in it. We also got a story from Clive Barker and China Mieville. I'm definitely proud of that book.
It's a very impressive lineup right there.
Yeah. It's funny. It's a mostly reprint anthology. We have a couple of, actually three originals. Stephen gave an original because, of course, Stephen can write a story or a novel in like 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. His story is great and the originals as well. It was a lot of fun. John's one of my best friends, so it was just great to get to work with him. So, just wanted to throw, a shout out to Creatures.
And where can people find you online?
So people can find me online at paultrembley.net. My blog is thelittlesleep.com. But I'm all over like Facebook and Twitter as well. As we all are. We're doomed to be on social media for the rest of our lives.
I have a feeling that the Facebook thing is going to get old eventually. And by eventually, I mean sooner rather than later. I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not.
No, I think you're wrong.
What does Kurt Vonnegut have to think about that?
I'm sure he probably didn't put too much thought into it.
Oh, if only we can get Vonnegut on the show.
Yeah.
It's our David Foster Wallace joke every time that comes up too. You know, we got to get a way to get that guy on the show. Paul, thank you for taking time out of your hectic moving around schedule to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me on. This was a blast talking to you guys. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, once again, big thanks to Paul Tremblay for coming on. I'm really glad I got another Vonnegut lover on my side now.
Oh, God, here we go. I'll tell you what, though. Not only do we talk a little bit of math, we got a pronunciation lesson. It's cheesine. Am I saying that right now?
Cheesine.
Cheesine. God damn it.
Come on, cheesine. Already.
Which you said was short for something, but, you know, I'm not going to say on the actual show, you know, I'm not going to name names, but you know who I'm talking about who says cheesine, right?
Like everybody else in the world?
Well, yeah, I was referring to someone specific, but we learned, and now we can school somebody else on cheesine.
Yeah, we're going to act all smart and better than them. I know who you're talking about. Back to Paul a little bit for more about Paul Tremblay's works and stuff and where you can find it. Head over to paulgtremblay.com. We'll have a link on the website. We'll probably link up the Swallowing a Donkey's Eye. And he was talking about that anthology Creatures, which has just a billion awesome authors in it, or awesome authors. So I'll probably throw a quick link up for that as well.
That whatever you said, that's the creature in the fourth story.
The Otham Ossers?
Yes.
It probably came from somewhere near New Zealand too.
Yes. Just write that story and send it to Cheesine and see if they Cheesine. Cheese. It's like cheese, right?
Like, cheese. Yeah, cheese, like Wisconsin.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Or Vermont.
Hey. Do you know what's going to be very special about our next episode?
I don't know what.
You know, we don't do often enough. We don't review enough fiction by women.
This is very true.
So we are going to review Megan Abbott's latest book, Dare Me.
That's right. And somewhere in the world, Sean Ferguson's heart just started to go at a bit of a faster pace.
God, Sean Ferguson has gotten way too many mentions this episode. You need to go back and edit out every single time someone says Sean Ferguson and replace it with, I don't know, whatever, Dan Donchi.
Did you notice at the beginning of the previous episode, I used Sean's little intro and I bleeped out part of it?
I didn't catch the bleeping.
Oh, yeah. I bleeped Sean a little bit. Wow, we can just do that. I can go back and I can bleep out his name. So just like, Sean, for, you know, like.
Do that just to piss him off.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, so this thing about Dare Me, it is Amazon's one of the best books of the month for August. So, I'm really looking forward to this. So here's the track record. Going backwards, 50 Shades of Grey, we didn't think very highly of that. The Wolf Gift was by Anne Rice. We didn't think very highly about that. But one of our favorite books of last year was The Night Circus, which we absolutely loved.
By Erin Morgenstern.
I think that's the only three like full length books we've read by women. Does that sound right to you?
Right. I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah. 103 episodes and we've managed to review three books, full length books by women. So
to be fair though, of those episodes, probably about 50 to 60 were books. So still that's a really bad number.
Sure. Well, either way, we're gonna increase our female reviews by 33%. Right now, next week.
That's right. We're practically feminists.
We are, almost. And you know what? We talk about Amanda Gowan quite a bit.
It's true.
Nikki Girling, Paleo. So we talk about women's. Yeah. We just don't read them very much.
We'd like to have them on the show.
This is true.
We just don't think they can write. All right, that's not true. Of course, that's not true.
You may want to go back and trim that out along with every mention of Sean Ferguson. All right. Well, until next time, I'm Olivia Sneddon.
And I'm Rob Olson. Keep reading women's fiction.